Time now for the interview portion of our program. Today on InfoSec Radio, we bring you part two of our interview with Kevin Mitnick. Having all that support behind you, has it made it any easier in negotiating under your terms of your release to do things like speaking and writing engagements? Is that sort of support behind you, is that added weight when you're before the court?
I don't think so. I don't think the court or the probation department really cares about the support. I do think they have a concern about the media coverage, and I think it's like a double-edged sword. I think the media coverage of my case, especially with the inaccurate reporting and the myth of Kevin Mitnick that was created by the New York Times and subsequently snowballed into being reported in the national and international media as fact, I think that had an absolute detrimental effect on my case, and my attorney advised me during my pretrial detention, which happened to be for 4.5 years, I was held without a trial, that it would be wise for me not to speak or to be interviewed by the media, so I never could say my side of the story, and now that I'm speaking out and the media is covering my case in, I think, a much better way, that it might be having a positive effect. But then again, the more high profile, the best thing when you're under the scrutiny of Department of Justice is to maintain a low profile. And unfortunately, that option is not available in my case. So hopefully I'll be able to, be myself and discuss issues that people are interested in, hearing my side of the story. And hopefully the media reporting will be fair.
In hindsight, do you think that maybe things might have been different had you not taken your attorney's advice and had spoken out at the time?
No, I really don't know. The problem is federal prosecutors are very, very talented at taking somebody's words and twisting them in a sense that makes it very negative for that person, because the only thing they have to do is push the district court judge's buttons And the prosecutors in my case were very adept at doing it in my case. They were very good at pushing her button. The government was very articulate at really pushing the judge's buttons to get her angry. And they used this strategy all throughout the entire litigation to really poison the court against the defense.
You've been quoted now, or it's been reported that you've been quoted, that you now want to give lectures on the negatives of hacking and how it's not something people want to do. Given the large amount of support you received from the Black Hat community and the Free Kevin movement, do you think that this in any way is a slap in the face to the people who supported you while you were in jail?
No, well, I'm not lecturing on the negatives of hacking. What I'm going out and speaking to is the methodology, who are the hackers as distinguished from the attackers? Because, hackers aren't criminals. In my mind, there is not all hackers are criminals. I mean, you know, some hackers can commit crimes, but I think hackers are really about people that are creative and inventive, and the engineers of today, in my mind, are hackers. The people that develop airplanes, the people that work on cars, the people that do hacking is about stretching the technology to do things that it wasn't originally intended to do, and about coming up with shortcuts and making programs more elegant. Like, for instance, years ago when memory was expensive, you try to write your code to use the least memory as possible. And just stuff like that. I think it's a very, a learning experience of, taking things apart to see how they work, and the thrill and the insatiable, appetite for curiosity and intellectual challenge is behind hacking. And I never intended, and I don't think I was quoted as saying that I'd be lecturing on the negatives of hacking. The only thing that I've said before is now, because of the cost of computer systems has come down from what it was years ago when, I was started hacking in the late 70s, that people could set up their own networks or hack networks in which they have permission to do so and not violate anybody's privacy, and they still get the same type of intellectual challenge, thrill, and learning experience without affecting anybody else. But what I was going to be talking about when I speak about computer security is just the who the hackers are, not all hackers are bad, and that a lot of hackers have actually revolutionized the computer industry. I consider people like Dennis Ritchie and Ken Thompson the people that developed the Unix operating system hackers. I believe that Steven Jobs and Stephen Wozniak, who invented Apple computer, are hackers of a sense, and they've all done good for the industry. What I intend to talk about when I do my talks is kind of like who the hackers are, what methodology or how do attackers break into your networks, and what are some of the things that you might do to mitigate the risk. So those are the things that that I intend to talk about, and not really get up on a soapbox and say how bad hacking is.
What do you say then to the folks who say that they shouldn't be, we shouldn't be taking advice from a convicted hacker like you? They often use the analogy of hiring someone like you to present a keynote as the same as hiring a burglar to secure your bank.
Well, then those people don't have to take the advice. They can simply go elsewhere.
At this point in time, I think a lot of people also want to know what you're doing then to support yourself. Are you receiving any funding from the Free Kevin movement? Who's paying the legal bills and who's supporting you now?
Well, I do owe legal bills, but I don't have any monies coming in for that, and I'm supporting myself. I've been involved in going to be writing a column for Contentville, and my first column I think is going to be published in September. I have a keynote address that I'm going to be delivering at the end of September at a conference here in Los Angeles. My agent is closing a deal with KFI because I'm going to try out hosting a talk radio program. So there's a lot of things, a lot of doors of opportunity opening at this time, and that's how I'm going to be supporting myself.
Let's go back in time. As you know, this series is a three-part series on hacking through the ages. During your incarceration, a lot of your detractors would refer to you as the equivalent of a modern-day script kiddie, low on skills and relying on other people's tools. Given that there's a considerable amount of sniping in the entire Black Hat community, those comments are probably not very true. Can you give us a brief outline of some of your technical skills at the time?
Yeah, well, just to clarify, I really don't care what other people think about my skills. Just like, foreign governments would love to know the nuclear capabilities of this country, the less people know about my capabilities, as far as I'm concerned, is the better. And my technical skills, I've worked as a computer programmer, writing programs. I've worked doing system and network administration, and I have a good understanding of, computer security. I don't say that I know, I'm the know-it-all of everything. I believe that there's people that are smarter than me, and there's people that are less smarter than me. And with that said, I know how to type, and I know how to program, and I understand, I have a good understanding of how certain, the vulnerabilities worked that I was using. Now, did I write any of my own tools? Usually, when I was hacking, I really, if I wanted to do something automated against a series of, or wanted to execute a thing, or execute a series of commands against several different targets, I'd usually write a script. Back in 1995, there wasn't the tools that are available today, and so a lot of it was done, kind of like by hand, and wasn't like today where anybody can download a tool and sweep a network and try to find machines or boxes on that network that a person or the attacker could talk to, and then trying to determine what ports are open, and then identifying the operating system, and then going into a vulnerability database and, figuring out what exploits are available. That wasn't available back in 1995. In fact, my interests were, I had certain specific objectives. I was very interested in cellular communications. I wanted to know how the protocols, how it worked internally. I wasn't interested in reverse engineering the firmware, which could take years of time. So I decided, look at the source code. So I set out about going and getting into companies that developed the cellular phone source code. And some of the tools I used, most of the tools I used was really my own mouth by speaking. but you know, using social engineering techniques and combining it with technical attacks. And some of the tools that I've used were, you know, developed by others. A lot of them I just did it by hand. That's not to say I don't know how they worked. Of course I knew how they worked. It wasn't simply a point-and-click type tool that's available like today. I guess that's really what I can say about that.
Well, what were you doing at the time that nobody else was? You were working with VMS?
Yeah, pretty much. I wasn't really as interested in Unix as I was VMS. I had particular operating systems that I enjoyed over others because I was kind of brought up, you know, in school and using those operating systems, and you just get, you know, usually how people are is once they get used to something, they don't like to change. But I did learn a lot about Unix and a lot about the vulnerabilities when I was involved in hacking. In fact, I used to, in fact, my enjoyment was actually targeting the systems of people that were, you know, the top vulnerability researchers that discovered these holes. And I figured, you know, those individual systems would be harder to get into and would really present a challenge. So those are the systems that I went after, and I was usually, you know, successful. And then also my interest was in, you know, cellular technology. And, you know, would I spend the time to go ahead and write a tool from scratch when my objective was to get a source code tree and a certain version of cell phone firmware? No. What I would do is, you know, go ahead and, you know, see what was available, you know, either through my sources in the underground or that were publicly developed by companies or other people. And that's to say, does anybody that needs to use a spreadsheet, any hacker that wants to use a spreadsheet program today, do they just launch on their Excel icon if they're using Windows, or do they go ahead and write a spreadsheet application from scratch? So I would have never accomplished my objective if I did everything from scratch. Of course, I depended on a lot of techniques and tools that were available out there to accomplish my objective.
Given that it was such a small community at the time, how much sharing was going on between yourself and other people active at that time?
Well, I usually associated with a very small group of people. I would say less than five. And I was very selective in, you know, who I associated with.
It's been said, and you brought it up a little earlier, that you're a master of social engineering, and that may be, in fact, your most effective skill as an attacker. Do you agree with that?
Well, yeah, I agree. Social engineering it was kind of surprising to me, but I was so successful at doing, you know, social engineering attacks that sometimes I wouldn't even have to bother with a technical attack. But what made me such an effective, you know, computer hacker, if you will, was the ability to combine social engineering attack techniques with technical attacks. And having both of those disciplines was invaluable at penetrating network infrastructures.
Tell us your favorite social engineering story, something that you did.
Well, one day when I was on the lam living in Denver, Colorado, I was working for this law firm, and then there was a brochure on somebody's desk that they let me see on I think it was the Motorola MicroTac Ultralight. That looked like a pretty neat phone. And so on the way home, on my cellular phone, I called 800 information from Motorola. And within seconds, I was able to find out where the engineering group was, the site was called the Cellular Subscriber Group, where they were in Schaumburg, Illinois. And then I basically called on their public number and asked for somebody in the engineering group on this particular project. Well, I don't think the telephone operator really had a good idea of the different project managers in the organization, so I was transferred to, I think, this high-level manager. And he informed me that the person that works on the NAMPS MicroTac project was this lady named Pam. So I called back the number of the switchboard and was able to to get Pam's extension. I called, and there was a voicemail message from Pam basically saying that she was on vacation, and if anybody needed any help, you know, to contact, you know, so-and-so. So, you know, I figured, oh, great. So, you know, so-and-so's extension was on her voicemail. So I thought, okay, let's see if this worked. And I just did it impulsively. And I called that so-and-so and said, hey, Pam told me to call you when you're on vacation and I need your help with something. And I told her that what I was looking for was a certain version of the firmware for this MikroTik ultralight phone. And she spent some time with me on the phone, and to make a long story short, I was able to explain to her how to basically take the source code to that particular version and compress it into one file, and then mail that file. Well, not actually mail it, but actually transfer it outside of Motorola's campus to an internet service provider in Colorado. So within, I'd say, a half hour of being on the telephone and without any callbacks or any verification that I was a legitimate employee, I had the source code to the firmware in Motorola's newest cellular telephone.
You were quoted in the Washington Post as saying that the weakest link in the security chain is the human element. Does this human element mean that there's always going to exist a degree of insecurity in communications technology, certainly in terms of you know, your skills as a social engineering?
Well, absolutely, because you know, the only way to prevent social engineering is by education, and more education. And unfortunately, the larger the organization, the more employees, the more chances somebody has to possibly use the art of persuasion to manipulate somebody. And unfortunately, since these large organizations, since everybody doesn't know on a personal level everybody else, how do people really verify that you are who you say you are? They usually do it by, you know, calling you back on the telephone, by looking in the telephone company directory, by using a facsimile, by using email, by using voicemail. And all those methods of authentication could be easily circumvented. For instance, at one cellular phone company in that provided, you know, telephone service in Los Angeles, I was able to call up the voicemail administrator of that company and say I was with another sales office and that I'd be in town on 30 days working on a special project. Would he be kind enough to set me up a phone? And then after it was confirmed, I'd say, well, I really don't need the actual physical phone in the cubicle if you can just set me up a voicemail box. And within an hour, I had a voicemail box on this company's internal voicemail system. So anytime anybody would question the authenticity of my request, they would just call me back. They go, what's your extension? And give them a valid extension, you know, off their, you know, PBX. And I'd say, well, I'm on the phone a lot, so if you get to my voicemail, just leave me the information on my voicemail. And I, you know, and I don't know, the voicemail box still may exist today. I haven't checked, and I don't plan to.
What role do you think that you've had in the evolution of information security and perhaps the perception of the average computer user about the security of their machines and their networks? You're pretty high profile, and you were at the beginning of all this.
Well, I think because of the sensationalism and hyped-up reporting about me, especially above the fold and on the front page of the New York Times, and again, a lot of libelous information being printed about me, things I did not do, but that would represent a serious threat to our country, like, you know, having control of nuclear missiles, so to speak. I believe it exploited, you know, the fear and the mystique around computers, and I think it probably had an effect of raising the awareness of people that computers aren't safe, and I think that even some individuals are really concerned about conducting e-commerce over the net because they're giving out private information that they fear might be intercepted by, you know, by unauthorized parties.
Do you think that that sort of FUD is mostly responsible for the public's fascinations with hacking and hackers?
I think it's the mystique and the fear. You know, I think, unfortunately, that the public equates the term hacker with the term criminal. And my argument is not all hackers are bad, and a lot of them have done a lot to advance, you know, technology in the computer industry. But you do have people out there that are malicious that will try to steal financial information, divert financial assets, engage in industrial espionage. You have those, you know, truly criminal types, but most hackers are really out for the recognition, the respect, the publicity, the, you know, kind of the bragging rights and the showing off, the learning, the curiosity, the intellectual challenge, the thrill, you know, and sometimes pulling pranks. You know, I really consider the majority of, you know, hackers today being people that are just intensely interested in learning about computer technology and probably have the prankster, arrogant attitude, but they're really not all that bad. But then you have a group of people, unfortunately you can't stereotype hackers, but then again you have a group of people that will have no problems in crashing computer systems, corrupting information databases, destroying information, doing denial of service attacks. You're going to have those group of people doing those sorts of things, and it's probably out of acts of hate or revenge or frustration that these people could not break into Yahoo.com, so I couldn't break in, so I'm just going to go ahead and do a denial of service attack. You might have that type of mentality, which is senseless and juvenile. So you have a wide spectrum of people. People, you know, on one end that are harmless learners that are just interested in exploring technology, to the other end where you're going to have foreign adversaries try to break into critical information infrastructures here in the United States to, you know, to interfere with water, power, transportation, banking, finance, you know, anything that could, power grids, anything that could interfere with the American way of life. So it's really difficult to, again, to be redundant, it's difficult to stereotype these people.
Do you think we are witnessing the birth of a new intelligentsia?
Well, I think we're in the information age, and it's going to be interesting in how things play out.
From your perspective, how has the hacking scene evolved since the early days? I mean, what sort of trends have you taken notice of today?
Recently, since my release from custody, what I've really noticed, and, you know, again, I haven't, you know, since I can't go online or can't use a computer and only I have the ability to talk to people that, and, you know, I've talked to many people that went to H2K and DEF CON recently, and it seems like, you know, computer hackers are realizing that security is a real hot topic, and all these businesses that want to conduct their business over the internet are fearful of doing so because of the security implications. And a lot of these guys are figuring, you know, it's like, what's the ideal world to do your hobby and get paid for it? So now I see a direction towards commercialism, where hackers are trying to get jobs as security analysts or penetration testers or developing tools to assist people in improving their security and getting paid for it at the same time. So it's like they're getting the best of both worlds.
It seems that we're still wrestling with how to properly secure networks. You know, the internet, which are all essentially connected physically, with all the controllability, of course, that physical connection would seem to imply. However, we're now witnessing a tremendous growth in wireless technologies, such as PDAs, two-way messaging, remote email, and, of course, the ubiquitous cell phone. Given the problems that network administrators and most regulatory bodies have with securing physically connected networks, what do you think is going to be the security implications of an increasingly prevalent wireless society and wireless communications?
Well, I think I even heard recently that there was some vulnerability with some wireless technology or service. I don't recall what the specifics were, but I really think unless security is designed into the process, you know, from the design of these systems and not as an afterthought where you build security on, you know, a weak foundation, I believe that it's possible. And I really think the only way to really secure wireless communications or communications that even, you know, transverse through the internet or go over, you know, publicly switched networks or even through the, you know, telephone company is to use encryption. And I'm really an advocate of strong encryption because it really solves a lot of problems with network sniffing, hijacking, network connections, protecting the confidentiality, the integrity of the information. It really doesn't go anywhere to the availability, because even when, say, a user is connecting to a host and they're downloading a piece of software over a network, an attacker that's in the middle could actually send them, either can corrupt that information if it's in the clear, or actually, in cases that I've heard of, send them a completely different version of the program that they're requesting. So it's pretty scary, and I think, at least in the physical world, if Internet service providers kind of went to, like, VPN, of course it would be an overhead, because anytime you use encryption, there's an overhead involved. But, if the whole Internet backbone was encrypted, I think it'd really advance, really take care of a lot of the problems, at least with network sniffing. But with wireless, I think unless some security design is built into the system, that there will be problems. And then again, you have the federal government that doesn't want strong encryption that they can't break. And then you wonder what rules and regulations is forcing upon the manufacturers of this stuff to weaken their encryption algorithms to allow the government to eavesdrop on communications. So I think it's all going to be very interesting, and I'm interested in how it's going to play out.
Kevin, I want to thank you for joining us today and being so candid. We appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Dan. Glad to be here.